Michael Young will present an argument for the petition.
May it please this honorable court. My name is Michael Young, and I am with the firm of Mr. Royal Brand, who is unavoidably absent on this occasion. And
I thought you were Mr. Strasburger.
Well, Your Honor, I joined the firm after Mr. Strasburger passed on.
Is Strasburger and Price?
Yeah. It is, Your Honor.
All right. We'll let you say you're here for the firm of Brand. Go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. In this workers' compensation case, the plaintiff and respondent in this court, Ben Weinberg, appealed from a summary judgment rendered by the trial court in favor of the defendant and petitioner in this court, American General Fire and Casualty Company. The trial court's summary judgment was based on the plaintiff's failure to timely file his suit in the district court within 20 days after filing a notice of appeal with the Industrial Accident Board, as is required by the workers' compensation statute. The facts with respect to the merits of the trial court's decision are as follows. Within the required 20 days after the decision of the Industrial Accident Board, the plaintiff duly filed a notice of appeal from that award with the Industrial Accident Board's central office in Austin, Texas. Toward the end of the 20-day period in which such a notice could be filed, he delivered to the Dallas branch office of the Industrial Accident Board a photostatic copy, identical in all respects, even insofar as the original date, to the Dallas branch office of the Industrial Accident Board. The suit was filed in district court 29 days after the original notice filed in Austin and 16 days after the copy was filed in Dallas. All the parties concede that the suit was timely filed if the time is to be calculated from the filing of the copy in Dallas. And all parties concede that the suit was not timely filed if the time is to be calculated from the filing of the original notice in Austin. In the trial court and in the Court of Appeals, all parties centered on the merits of this question, whether the suit was or was not timely filed. In the trial court, the motion for summary judgment was based on that ground. The plaintiff's response was based on that ground. The trial court's decision was based on its ruling that the suit had not been timely filed. In the Court of Appeals, Mr. Weinberg's point of error and his entire brief was devoted to the merits of whether or not suit had been timely filed. And the responsive brief of American General was devoted to that same issue. Nevertheless, the Court of Appeals reached out to decide the case on a point which had been raised, neither raised nor argued nor briefed in either of the lower courts. It held that since American General had failed to file a verified denial under Rule 93 of the timeliness of the filing of suit, that that point had been waived and that the trial court should have conclusively presumed that the suit was timely filed. And it reversed the trial court's decision and remanded for trial. A petition for rehearing was duly filed in the Court of Appeals and overruled, and the writ of error perfected to this court. There are two issues presented for this court's decision by the writ of error. First, was the Court of Appeals correct in reversing the trial court's decision on a ground not presented to the trial court and not presented to the Court of Appeals by the appellant? Secondly, the merits of the timeliness question. Does the filing of a photostatic copy of a notice of appeal in a branch office of the board restart the time in which suit must be filed after notice of appeal has been filed? Turning to the first point, it is the general rule in this state and elsewhere that matters that are not asserted by an appellant will not be considered by an appellate court. Furthermore, a general rule that matters not raised in a trial court and properly preserved as error will not be considered by an appellate court as grounds for reversal of a trial court's opinion. Of course, every trial court's opinion is presumed to be correct, and a trial court may be affirmed for a reason not raised to the trial court. But this case goes further in the Court of Appeals opinion. and reverses a trial court's judgment on a ground not raised either before the trial court or before the Court of Appeals. This is especially true when we're talking about a summary judgment, which of course is governed by Rule 166A. Rule 166A expressly forbids reliance on appeal on any ground not raised in the trial court. It states, issues not expressly presented to the trial court by written motion, answer, or other response shall not be considered on appeal as grounds for reversal of the summary judgment. That is to say, if Mr. Weinberg had raised before the Court of Appeals the question of the lack of a verified denial, Rule 166A says he would not be heard to complain on that ground, having not raised that issue in opposition to the motion for summary judgment. A fortiori, if he will not be heard when he raises the issue, the Court of Appeals should not reach out to decide the issue when, in fact, the appellant has not even raised it. The case law establishes quite convincingly that pleading defects have been waived for purposes of summary judgment when they are not raised in the opposition to the motion for summary judgment. We have cited to the court by letter the recent case involving the City of San Antonio, decided by the San Antonio Court of Civil Appeals on December 30. For the court's convenience, that decision has just been printed in the Southwest Reporter, and the citation to that decision is 630 Southwest 2nd, 661, San Antonio Court of Appeals, 1981. To illustrate the length to which courts will go in holding pleading defects to be waived when not raised in opposition to a summary judgment, let us take a brief look at the case Murkison versus Post Independent School District, cited on page 20 of our petition for writ of error. In that case, not only was there not a verified denial or other technical defect in the pleadings, the defendant had in fact filed no answer whatsoever. Was, if you want to speak technically, in default. Nevertheless, by consent, by implied acquiescence, both of the parties reached the merits of the summary judgment question, briefed and argued those questions. The lack of filing of an answer was not raised, and the trial court proceeded to decide the merits of the summary judgment. On appeal, that result was affirmed, holding that since the parties by both pleadings and evidentiary matters have joined issues in the cause on all material points and tried the issues out fully under the procedure as to summary judgment, any defects as to pleading are not material here. This has been followed in a variety of cases dealing with lack of a verified denial, including cases in the specific context of a workers' compensation timeliness issue, and in cases involving other aspects of Rule 93. The cases cited by the Court of Appeals in its reversal of the trial court judgment are not applicable. The one case cited, which was decided by this court, the case of Southern Underwriters versus Tullis, involves a motion for directed verdict which was denied by the trial court, a motion based on the ground that there had been no verified denial, the response to which was that such had been waived. There was no question of relying on a ground not raised in the trial court for reversal. Indeed, the court expressly declined to reverse. In the other cases cited by the Court of Appeals, the points were raised on appeal and decided by the Court of Appeals. While in contrast, in this case, no issue was raised in the Court of Appeals. In sum, the merits of the question were presented to both the trial court and to the Court of Appeals with no suggestion of any issue involving a lack of verified denial. And the first time that that issue was raised by anyone was when the Court of Appeals rendered its opinion. Turning to the merits.
Before you do that, would you please distinguish, if you can, the case of American Employers against Scott?
Yes, Your Honor. That case deals with the merits, which is the issue to which I would like to turn. Mm-hmm. The Scott case involved a notice of appeal filed, a, quote, similar, close quote, notice of appeal filed again within the time for filing notices of appeal. And the court there held that the second notice was intended as an abandonment of the first notice and operated to start the time running within which suit must be filed. In the present case, the photostatic copy of the notice filed in Dallas cannot be regarded as an abandonment of the first notice for at least three reasons. First of all, it does not in any way alter the notice filed in Austin. It is verbatim, a photostatic copy of that notice, even down to having the original certified mail receipt number on it, the original date of the filing of the original notice in Austin. Secondly, it was not sent to the board office in Austin, as is required by the Industrial Accident Board rules for a notice of appeal, instead being sent to the branch office in Dallas. Third, it was not provided to the insurer, as must be done with a notice of appeal. There's an analogy here, pointed out in our petition for writ, to a circumstance where a district court vacates its original judgment and re-enters that judgment, with the only purported effect being that of extending the time for filing a notice of appeal. And it is uniformly held that that cannot be done.
Counsel, will you explain on those Industrial Accident Board rules that require notices to be sent to Austin?
Yes, Your Honor. The rules of the Industrial Accident Board, rule, we've got a complicated numbering system, 01.00.030E, states the following shall be filed with the board in Austin, and has a list of items which include notice of intention to appeal.
What is the basis?
I would presume, Your Honor, that it is under the authority given to the Industrial Accident Board to promulgate rules under the Workers' Compensation Statute, Section Articles 8306 and 8307. I don't have the specific provision that would authorize the board to promulgate those rules, but I would assume it's promulgated under that section.
Well, in the absence of authority, my first impression would be that the Act itself is controlled. If you send it to the board, they send it to the board and any of its officers. So that's the reason for the inquiry into the authority of the board to publish that rule.
I would submit, Your Honor, that the board has the inherent authority, if not the statutory authority, to prescribe reasonable rules for the conduct of its business.
What do you cite for that? Never heard of that rule. Boards don't have inherent power. At least I don't think they do.
Well, Your Honor,
you don't create a board and then all of a sudden it's gone with inherent powers. It'd be in awful shape.
Well, I agree, Your Honor. What I'm speaking about is power may be a bad word, but the ability to establish procedures which will govern its conduct and the conduct of those appearing before it. Of course,
I think I wrote an opinion for this court saying the Railroad Commission had no powers other than those specifically delegated to it by the legislature.
I understand, Your Honor. Again, this would be a rule simply giving the...
Well, is there such a statute giving them power? That's what he's asking.
I'm ashamed to admit, Your Honor, that I don't know specifically. I believe that there is a statute authorizing the board to promulgate rules and regulations for the conduct of its business, but I cannot point the court to such a statute at the moment.
Would you care to file a supplemental brief?
I'll be happy to, Your Honor. The rule, of course, is that a re-entry of a judgment for the sole purpose or with the sole effect of extending the notice of time to appeal is null and void. In Anderson versus Casebolt, this court said the second judgment could serve no purpose other than to enlarge the time for appeal and declined to calculate the appeal time from that second judgment. By direct analogy in this case, the filing of a photostatic copy of the notice of appeal with the board in Dallas could have served no purpose but to extend the time for filing the suit. And by analogy to Casebolt and to the cases decided under it, it must be held that the time runs from the first notice of appeal, the one filed with the board in Austin, and not from the copy of the notice of appeal filed with the board in Dallas.
Are you satisfied that the Scott case is correctly decided?
No, Your Honor, I'm not. I merely, in answer to Your Honor's question, point out that even if it is taken as a correctly decided case, it is not applicable to this case. In that case, the court found that the intention was to abandon the first notice, and that the second notice was, while similar, in effect a different notice. We don't have that situation here at all. The second notice was in no way different from the first, except having been filed later and with a different office. With respect to whether Scott was correctly decided, I think there's considerable question about that. The question there is, after one has taken the step of filing a notice of appeal, thereby depriving the Industrial Accident Board of the power to proceed and transferring the case once suit is filed to the trial court, whether any further action taken with the Industrial Accident Board with respect to the matters being appealed is of any effect at all is, I think, very doubtful.
How many branches has the Industrial Accident Board got? I know that's not in the record. But
I don't think it is in the record, Your Honor. I think there are several. I think there are one basically in each major city in Texas. My estimate would be 5 or 6, but I would have to verify that, and I'll be happy to do that.
All right.
We have a situation where, and I'm not suggesting that this was necessarily what happened in this case, but we have a situation where if a photostatic copy is effective to restart the time running, a plaintiff or anyone aggrieved by the decision of the Industrial Accident Board could, knowing that his time to file suit was about to run out, merely file a photostatic copy and thereby, in effect, obtain a single 40-day time limit from the time of the Industrial Accident Board decision to the filing of the suit, when the legislature has very clearly prescribed 2 separate 20-day periods. And if the remainder of the first 20-day period is not used up, the legislature, in its wisdom, has seen to start that second 20-day period from the date of filing of the notice of appeal. In other words, once the intention to appeal has been formulated, once it has been formally communicated to the board, to the opposing party, there's no just reason for more than 20 days delay in filing the lawsuit.
Counsel, I understand that the plaintiff, the claimant, alleged that he did not get any notice from the board that his notice of intent to appeal had been received.
He did not receive any notice until August 2nd, Your Honor, having filed the second notice with the board on August 1st. That's correct.
Well, is it so unreasonable for him to be concerned if he hadn't gotten notice, particularly in light of the condition the United States mails are in right now, that he would, to be careful, file another notice with all good intention, rather than to extend the time for appeal?
Not at all unreasonable, Your Honor, and if the case turned on whether that second notice constituted a sufficient notice of appeal to get him into court, there might very well be a different resolution. We do not fault Mr. Weinberg for having filed the second notice with the board. I presume that was done in an abundance of caution. And that is, we have no quarrel with that. The question before this court, though, is whether when that is done, that re-begins, so to speak, the time for filing the lawsuit. And where notice was promptly received by him on the day after he filed the photostatic copy, August 2nd, that the board had received and filed his original notice, the one filed in Austin. He was on notice that that notice had been filed when it had been filed, and that he had 20 days thereafter in which to file suit. In other words, Your Honor, he received notice that the first notice had been filed in ample time for him to have filed his lawsuit within 20 days after that first notice. I believe, Your Honors, that concludes my presentation. I'd be happy to answer any further questions that you may have. As Mr. Chief Justice Greenhill has requested, we will file a supplemental brief addressing the authority of the Industrial Accident Board to promulgate its rule, and I'll also try and look up exactly how many branch offices the board does have.
If that's a matter of official record, we wouldn't want to enlarge the record.
Of course not, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel. Any argument from the respondent?
May it please the Court, Mr. Brian A. Epstein will present the argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. My name is Brian Eberstein. I am a sole practitioner in Dallas, Texas, and represent the respondent in this matter. An attorney who previously worked for me was the attorney that was originally handling this case, and I am here today, though, representing Mr. Weinberg. First, let me say that this is my first opportunity to be before this court, and I am very proud to be here today and appreciate the time being given me by the court. Quickly to the case, I would suggest that the arguments proposed not only are specious in terms of the allegations made, but are patently out of line with what we know the rules of the Industrial Accident Board to be. Specifically, above the rule that was cited to the court with regard to where notices shall be followed, the rule says that all parties seeking any action in the board shall comply with these rules unless, in its judgment, the board determines that compliance with any of the rules under particular circumstances will result in injustice to either or both parties. The Industrial Accident Board is a board that was formulated, established to address the injuries to workers. It was not a board that was formulated to close its eyes to problems with regard to the United States mails or with regard to other problems that come up from time to time. Indeed, our rules are even forgiving with respect to errors made in some instances with regard to time. And nevertheless, the rules we're talking about here, the rules of the Industrial Accident Board, would certainly allow a claimant who was concerned about the time to file a notice in the city in which he lived. There are regional offices, I believe, in 10 cities in the state, Dallas being one of them. Mr. Smith became concerned when he did not receive a notice from the Industrial Accident Board that the notice of intention to appeal had been received. So the Industrial Accident Board office being in Dallas, he went, he copied his notice and went down and filed another one. And by the way, as I'm sure members of this court know, these notices are a matter of formality. They're not lengthy. They only say that we do not intend to abide by the decision of the Industrial Accident Board and we intend to appeal this matter. And in fact, that was the next step that was done. With respect to the suggestion that it would lengthen the time granted by the legislature, I disagree wholeheartedly with that also. There's never going to be any more than 40 days. The notice that was filed, the second notice, if you will, was filed at a time within the 20-day time period, and then following that, the lawsuit was filed within the 20-day time period. It's an absolute impossibility for there to be any extension of time. I would suggest further that the Scott case, which was inquired about, has never been overruled. And the facts in the Scott case are exactly as the facts in this particular case. There was a second notice, and I have been able to find no other case in Texas that is on point such as the Scott case. The Scott case involved a second notice filing, and the court in that particular case, that's the Eastland Court, decided that the time would begin to run from the filing of the second notice. There has been the question or the issue raised at any particular time with respect to what we're trying to do in terms of injured workers. We're trying to give them an opportunity, I believe, to file their notice and then to file their lawsuit, and to do it within certain prescribed time limits. What Mr. Young, would ask this court to do would be to shorten those time limits. And I don't think the court is interested in doing that. Certainly the court in the Scott case, which is a very old case, strangely, this matter has never evidently has never come before this court or come before any other appellate court since that time. The court in the Scott case addressed this question and said that the time should begin to run from the second notice. Briefly, with respect to the question of the verified pleadings, I would point out that Rule 93 and further Article 8307 are specific with regard to the question of these industrial accident claims, again making them sort of a special case. They say that if the defendant in this particular case, American General, doesn't file a sworn pleading, that the matters with regard to the notice and so on will be deemed to be true. And elsewhere in Rule 93, with respect to other matters that have to be verified, there is no such admonition to the party who is filing the answer that if he's not careful and if he doesn't file a verified answer, then certain things are going to be deemed to be true. But with respect to the issues dealing with industrial accident cases, that is the case. Industrial accident cases have been given special treatment. We have a special board that has been set up to handle these cases, and I think that is important for this court to consider, specifically with regard to the question of Rule 93 and the question of the verified pleadings. But that, I would suggest to the court, it is an important issue, but the important issue is the question of the merits. Because if the court sends this back and says, well, the pleadings weren't verified, and we send it back to the trial court, certainly we're just going to be met with amended pleadings that will be verified. So the real question, as I see it, is the question of the merits with regard to the notice.
Before we get to the merits, counsel,
yes, sir.
I think some members of the court are disturbed about the use of fundamental error or whatever by the Court of Appeals, acting on unassigned error. As I understand it, the Court of Appeals in this case ruled on unassigned error.
Yes, that's correct.
Now, so it would, I guess, fundamental error.
I would assume that to be their thinking, yes, sir.
And I understand that this court does not look with great approval on fundamental error, except in matters involving interests of the state. Very narrow line of cases on fundamental error. Now, that's a hill we've got to get over, as I understand it.
Well, in terms of the court's ruling and the opinion, as I know this court has read, is very brief. I would suggest it has to do with the unusual treatment given in Rule 93 with respect to industrial accident cases. The rules, Rule 93, only tracks the statute 8307 Section 5. And I think, again, trying to read the minds of the judges, and I would suggest I'm not real good at doing that, but I think it has to do with the unusual treatment given specifically to industrial accident board cases and to industrial accident cases. And that would be my only suggestion as to how the court got to the unassigned error and said we don't have to get to the merits of the case because we see that the pleadings aren't verified. As I said, the rule does give industrial accident cases very special treatment. And if certain matters are not sworn to, then they are deemed to be true, specifically the filing of the lawsuit and notices and the like.
You're not suggesting, or are you, that fundamental error ought to be applied in a workers' comp case if a worker loses?
If a worker loses, should fundamental error
or
be...
Or not.
No, I'm not suggesting that. I'm suggesting that in this particular case, if I had offering my opinion as to how they got to that point, I think the court was impressed that the pleadings weren't sworn to and that summary judgment was rendered, and I believe they probably felt that to be basically unfair, and that they again, looking at unassigned error, they may have thought it was fundamental error.
In a suit on sworn account, the defendant does not deny the account under oath, and the parties come in and try the case. There's no objection, no complaint. On appeal,
Do you think it would be proper for the Court of Civil Appeals to look through all of the trial and the argument and say there was no sworn denial, therefore the plaintiff wins?
No, I think if the parties, go to the courthouse and they agree to try a particular case.
No, they don't agree. They just try it.
Well, I think they have agreed, Your Honor. I think that they're trying it under Rule 67, under those facts and circumstances, would be an agreement to try it, even assuming that there were no sworn denials to the account. And I don't think that they could be heard to complain at the time that they reached the Court of Civil Appeals. In this particular case, there was never a trial. There was summary. This was a summary disposition of the matter. I think that is significantly different than the example that you cite to me, Your Honor.
Well, suppose in the sworn account case, the defendant came in with a summary judgment, just a general denial, no sworn denial. The defendant comes in with a summary judgment. Trial court acts on it. No objection to the pleadings. Trial court rules and goes up to the Court of Civil Appeals. Court of Civil Appeals determines that without any point, without any one having raised the question, that there was not a sworn denial, therefore the plaintiff wins.
And the trial court had ruled favorably for the plaintiff's motion for summary judgment?
No,
or ruled unfavorably?
For the defendant's motion.
For the defendant's motion for summary judgment?
My point is, my concern is that an error in pleadings can be raised as fundamental error. That's pretty far-reaching.
Well, I wonder why the, with regard to Rule 93, and it says, in the trial of any case appealed to the court from the Industrial Accident Board, the following, if pleaded, shall be presumed to be true. That treatment is that is given special treatment. Now, it was given special treatment presumably because the legislature wanted to do so and because they felt that these cases required some treatment different than the sworn account, as an example. And I would suggest that that 8307, which is simply tracked in Rule 93, and that the general body of workers' compensation law maybe is a special body of law. You know, we have 8306, 8307. It's not contained in the special section of our statutes. I think special treatment is to be afforded that particular area of the law.
In the past, fundamental error has been applied under Ramsey versus Dunlop only when there's a constitutional question involved and the rights of the whole public. In fact, within the last 6 weeks in the Buckhoven case, we struck down a case saying that the disqualified judge was not fundamental error unless they made a motion to remove the judge.
Yes, I recognize the problem with regard to the unassigned error, and I recognize that it's a significant problem for this court. I would suggest that the concern of the legislature for the workers in the state of Texas is a significant concern, and we're dealing with a very large segment of the population. Numbers I can't give you, but I would respectfully suggest to the court that it is a large, large number of the population of the state of Texas that are affected by 8306 and 8307. Special treatment to be afforded in the form of a fundamental error? I don't know. That aside, I would suggest that in terms of the merits of the case, there should be no question but that if the worker files his claim and then his lawsuit within the time limits it's given, and if he files a first claim and files a second claim, and all of this occur within the jurisdictional time limits, that he should be allowed the maximum length of time set out by the statute. I have nothing further except again to thank you for allowing me to appear before you today and to tell you that it was a pleasure to be here.
Thank you, sir. Is there a rebuttal argument from the petitioner?
I'm sorry, was the court addressing this?
No, sir, I said we hear further argument from petitioner. I just I'll speak up.
May it please the court. I'll attempt to be brief and sparing of the court's time. With respect to the question of fundamental error, which Mr. Justice Pope raised, we submit that it is not fundamental error in this case, especially in light of the provisions of Rule 166A. Those provisions are not merely mandatory to the appellant, but in their wording they would appear to be mandatory to the court. They say, issues not presented to the trial court shall not be considered on appeal. Not, may not be raised, but shall not be considered. And in light of that, we submit that the failure to file a verified denial was not fundamental error, since it was not raised in opposition to the motion for summary judgment. The failure to file a verified denial is not jurisdictional. There is no special public interest involved. While perhaps it is true that there are large numbers of workers' compensation claimants within the state, one would hope that there are not large numbers who fail to timely file, perfect their appeal from the IAB decision. And the rule that the court, the application of fundamental error by the Court of Appeals, would affect only a small group of individuals, and as was suggested, there's nothing particular about a workers' compensation case which would warrant fundamental error treatment as in the public interest. Responding to Mr. Justice Pope's analogy to a sworn account, we submit that if the plaintiff failed to raise in opposition to the defendant's motion for summary judgment the fact that there was no sworn denial of the account, that that issue, like the issue of failure to timely file, would also be waived. Similarly, if the parties proceeded to trial without raising that issue, it would likewise be waived. This is all part of the general rule of Rule 166A and the general rule that error must be preserved in the court below. And that has not been done in this case. With respect to the question of extending or shortening or altering the time for filing a notice of appeal, this court is not being asked to shorten any notice, any time period. The legislature did not prescribe a 40-day time period from the decision of the board to the filing of the suit. It was very specific in prescribing two 20-day periods and indicated that when the notice of appeal is filed before the 20th day, that triggers a new time period of another 20 days. And the overall time period may be as short as one day or as long as 40 days. But the 40-day provision is not one established by the legislature. It is a 20-day provision. With respect to the overruling of the Scott case, the Scott case was decided in 1930 by a court of civil appeals, writ of error refused by this court. It was based on a procedural analogy which was appropriate at that time, but which has long since ceased to be appropriate. That is, the filing of a cost bond after the filing of a notice of appeal. As the court well knows, the filing of the cost bond is now keyed to the filing of the judgment in the case. The Scott case was a filing of a cost bond following a notice of appeal from an overruling of a motion for a new trial. Under the present procedural system, the filing of the cost bond again is triggered not from the overruling of a motion for a new trial, but from the time of the judgment. Finally, on the question which the court raised concerning the power of the Industrial Accident Board to promulgate rules and regulations, I find in the appendix to our brief the preface to the rules states that all of the following rules are promulgated under the authority of Article 8307, Section 4, Vernon, Texas Civil Statutes, that they were promulgated as emergency rules in the Texas Register according to the Administrative Procedure Act on to be effective on August 29, 1977. I'd be happy to verify that information and file it by way of a supplemental brief. The court has no further questions.
Thank you, sir.
court has any further questions, I'd be pleased to answer them. Otherwise, that concludes my presentation.
Mr. Cady, it involves time. How much time do you want to file your brief?
I'd be happy to file it within 10 days, 2 weeks.
How about 1 week?
That's fine, Your Honor.
All right. Counsel for the respondent, may have a week to reply.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. The case is submitted on written briefs.
Action with the jury misconduct made no findings that he did or did not. When he overrules your motion, there are some cases that say, and I think maybe by this court, that the inference is, number one, that the misconduct did not occur. Now, it may be that it occurred on this one or this one, but within that inference, there would be the inference from the judges overruling the motion for new trial based on misconduct that some of these things did not occur. Now, you can overcome that, like you can overcome any finding, and that is by showing to this court that all of the evidence is that it did occur. I'd like your comment.
This is what we're attempting to do, Judge, and we think that in the case of Roaming versus McDonald, that that's exactly what the court did say. It says that the fact that the courts, that the juries, these jurors who testified didn't say, and I'm talking about the two jurors that were brought in by Mr. Cochran, they didn't say it didn't happen. They didn't say it didn't happen. They said, we don't recall it. That's the strong point, Judge, is that they never denied it. They never brought in Mrs. Sanchez, who said that it didn't happen. In other words, when the two jurors that says it did happen was the foreman, Mr. Braun and Miss Richards. They said that Miss Sanchez did say that she had a personal interest in this case. When, on the other hand, when she was in panel as a juror, she said she had no bias, she had no prejudice, she would be accepted as a fair and impartial juror. Yet again, when she goes in the jury room to deliberate, she tells the other jurors, I have a personal interest in this case. And that because of my personal interest, certain things I want done. Now, if this did not occur, they knew in our motion for new trial what we were bringing up. Mrs. Sanchez was identified in the affidavit. They didn't bring Mrs. Sanchez in to say it didn't happen. Now, what the court said in that Roaming case was that they had three jurors. And they said in that case that the fact that those jurors didn't deny it, that didn't mean it didn't occur. That only said that they didn't recall it, and that's exactly what's happened in this case. These jurors didn't deny it. Not one of them have denied it. The fact of the matter is, when we took one of the jurors that they brought in, and we asked them that very question, did it not occur, or did they not recall it? And they said, we just don't recall it. I think when we asked Mr. Vernon this very question, on page 37, do you say it didn't? That it didn't take place, or you just didn't recall it. Now, this was on the question of using wages, which had nothing to do with this case. There was nothing in this case about wages. And we asked this question, do you say it didn't take place, or you just don't recall it? And he answered, well, I do not recall it. Now, this is one of the items that the petitioner has cited as conflict in testimony here, but he doesn't cite what was testified to on cross-examination by us when this juror was brought in to be tell what he had heard or what he recalled.
Because I take it that what you're saying is that the testimony that you presented to the jurors you called was uncontradicted.
Correct.
What you're saying?
And we say that that supports the position of the Dallas Court of Civil Appeals. That's exactly what the Dallas Court of Civil Appeals said, is that there was no conflict. Because I agree with the law. I agree that the law says that if there was a conflict, that the reviewing court would be bound by that trial judge. I don't disagree with that being the law. But what I'm saying is that the Court of Civil Appeals in Dallas was correct. There was no conflict. That it's undisputed.
Did the trial judge have to believe the two dissenting witnesses? In other words, suppose the judge would take the attitude. I don't believe it. These other jurors didn't come forward with this.
Judge, it's not a... I, I would assume that from the cases that I've read, it's not necessarily a question of belief or disbelief if there was a conflict. In other words, that glass of water sitting in front of you, if I say it's half full and you say it's half empty, I don't think that's a conflict. I think we're talking about semantics now. We're talking about a conflict of facts that were testified to by Mr. Braun, the jury foreman. And we're talking about facts that were testified to by Mrs. Richards, a member of that jury panel. None of the things...
Didn't the trial judge think, well, now these two jurors are against that verdict, and they're in here trying to wreck it, and I just flat don't believe them. You don't think this is possible?
Judge, just like counsel was talking about the mental process of jurors, I wouldn't attempt to say what a trial judge might, what his mental processes would be. I have not had the privilege.
Is if one of the jurors says something is true, makes it undisputed evidence and the trial court is helpless.
But Judge, in some 30 years of practice, I've had trial judges tell me they won't disturb a jury verdict. I've had judges who pride themselves in 30 years of being on the bench said, I'm not going to disturb a jury verdict.
That answers the question.
I can't tell you whether the judge would say that I disbelieve that I feel that these two people are coming in trying to destroy a verdict. I can't answer that, Judge, because the court never indicated that.
The thing that the thing that we're driving at is that credibility is a fact matter, and that testimony becomes a matter of law in rare instances when it's clear, when it's undisputed, when the other side has an opportunity to contradict it and doesn't. And it's very seldom that credibility ceases to be a fact issue. If this is a fact issue, the judge acts and says, I deny the motion for new trial, that carries with it, as I say, as I asked a while ago, the inference that the misconduct did not occur.
Judge Pope, all of us are not infallible, including trial judges, and I find trying cases in the trenches are getting more difficult as each day goes by. And I find that when we have to be confronted with these things occurring in the jury room, that to come forward and say that a judge is going to say, well, these people, I mean, after all, when you and I start practicing law, we didn't have this problem because we didn't have a 10-2 verdict. In other words, you just had a hung jury. And we didn't have that situation. So the fact that we say that maybe two of them are coming back to destroy a verdict, I would hope that that's not true. I mean, as lawyers, I would hope that that is not what's happening to the jury system. I have a great faith in the jury system. And I would hope that's not what we're heading in the direction of people coming in after a verdict and two jurors who voted against it said, well, we can get back at these people. We'll go against it. I hope that's not the direction that we're heading. But I would like to call the court's attention to more than what has been called, and I'll stay within the statement of facts. When Mr. Braun testified, he was asked to tell the court what factors or elements were considered by the jury and discussed by the jury other than mental anguish, humiliation, and damage to reputation. And he says, well, now he's not talking about recollection. He's talking about what happened. This has not been refuted. He says, well, who would be the person or persons to actually pay the money, whether it was an insurance company, the corporation itself, and there was some discussion with contingency arrangements. And then he goes further on. He says, well, there was a discussion about how to set a sum to compensate him for his loss of earnings. That was the first portion of the where we had to decide how much money he was entitled to for mental anguish, I believe. And then he said that they had figures that were bounced around, and it didn't seem to make such a rhyme or reason as to how they arrived at a figure. And then he says, well, the conversation balanced about, people had pulled figures out of the air, and as foreman of the jury, I tried to make some basis, some grounds of suggestion whereby we could arrive and determine and ascertain how much money and wages was actually lost by the man. And simply, we took the man's wages, the wages he lost in making the day he had come to make his deposition, and we just multiplied it by three, and that's how we arrived at the $1,500. And we said, in addition to that, could you tell the court whether or not you also include the cost of his taking the deposition? That was all included. And then we asked him, what other elements? And he says, there were other elements taken into consideration other than the three elements that the court told you to limit your discussion to. And he said, yes, sir. And we asked him then, what other elements were discussed? And he says, a total loss of time away from his job, including the time that he'd take away from work to take his deposition. He then says, one of the jurors felt that in considering the punitive damages, that because the plaintiff was a black man, he might not have gotten a fair shake, and that was the only, it was just one or two sentences, and that was the end of that.
Now, counsel, why isn't that a mental process?
About the black man?
Black man. Or a white man not being able to get a fair shake at Treasure City.
Judge, I don't know that it's a mental process. In other words, it seems to me to be a statement that he considers as a statement of fact. That he's trying to say that there's a matter of fact that a black man couldn't get a fair shake.
Unless
he didn't say against...
Unless something that's going through his mind in a mental process.
Well, he's saying that this is what, we didn't ask him about a mental process, Your Honor. We asked him what was taken into consideration, and he said one of the jurors made that statement.
What was the statement exactly?
Sir?
What was the exact statement?
I'll read it again, Your Honor.
Well, just about the black man not getting a fair shake. What was the exact word?
He said because the plaintiff was a black man, he might not have gotten a fair shake. He didn't say he did or didn't. He said might not have gotten a fair shake. And that was only, it was one or two sentences, and that was the end of that.
Counsel.
Yes?
This may shock you, but we have a trial in which witnesses come in, black, white. This is a suit for false imprisonment. I don't know why that's not a legitimate thing for a jury to talk about. This is a suit for false imprisonment. The charge is that he didn't get a fair shake out there at Treasure City. And I wonder why the jurors can't say, well, this black man may not have got a fair shake out there.
Well,
in other words, is it wrong for the jurors that they can't just throw this fact out of their mind? That's what the lawsuit was about.
Judge, if that is true, if we'll follow through with what Ms. Sanchez said, and the quote from Mrs. Sanchez where she said she had personal reason. Now, here she may have considered herself as a part of the minority, and that she was relating with the minority. And if she says, well, I have personal reasons that they don't treat minorities right. Let's say that she says that. Now, if she has that feeling, Judge, and we asked the person on voir dire examination, do you have any subconscious feelings that you could not be a fair and impartial juror? Just as if they say, do you have anything against the person who drinks? I mean, let's say that you had a case involving drink. And today, believe it or not, many, many jurors will put their hands up and say, we don't drink and we don't believe in drinking. We'd rather not serve on that jury. In fact, we've had problems in the last two or three weeks where jurors in Dallas are saying, we don't believe that we can judge our fellow men. I've had several of them try to disqualify themselves on that theory, on religious reasons, saying we cannot sit here in judgment. And the judges have said, we're not asking you to judge your fellow man. We're asking you to judge facts. But we're running into that situation where people hold up their hand and say, well, I can't serve on a jury. That I can't judge my fellow man. Now, the very fact that you say a person might make that statement. I understand what the court is saying. I mean, this is a...
Where does that lead us to? They get on a jury and do judge? Does it tell a lie?
No, sir. I would say that what we need, Judge, what we would like is, if we could, we would try, I would say in trying a lawsuit, you'd like to get people. We understand that we're frail, that we all have, that none of us are perfect. But I think on the other hand, Judge, if a person had strong feelings about prejudices and so forth, I think that they would certainly, they would be compelled, I think, to tell the people that we have certain prejudices and we could not be fair to other people.
Making real good argument to me to go into the federal system and not find a jury when you get through. Because all of us are going to be frail and have some prejudices. You're not going to get a perfect jury anytime, any day, anywhere. I don't believe.
Well, it doesn't hurt to be idealistic and hope that we can, Judge. I think
we can't afford to try cases over and over and over again because of something like that.
No, sir, but let me say this because my time's running out. We have six items, Judge, that we say that couldn't be more damaging in a jury trial than what we have in this one. We're talking about insurance. We're talking about attorney's fees. We're talking about taxes. We're talking about race. We're talking about personal views outside of the realm of what went in evidence. And we're talking about lost wages. Had nothing to do in this type of lawsuit. There's no evidence on it. There's nothing whatsoever that they could bring this in. So if you take this in its entirety, and I think this is what the court in Dallas was saying, is that there was no conflict. They were not bound by as a reviewing court, as to be bound by that trial judge's findings, and that all of this together, as a matter of law, was probable harm and caused probable harm to Treasure City getting a proper verdict. So we're saying that with all of the things that occurred, and they're spelled out specifically and explicitly and just clear as crystal. There's no question that Judge Carver and Judge Guittard and Judge Story, in their opinion there, it was written by Judge Carver, set these things out one by one by one, and they reflect that they feel that all of these together would certainly cause probable harm to the defendant. We're asking the court to affirm the Court of Civil Appeals in Dallas because we feel that they're correct in their ruling, and that there was no conflict, that these things did occur, had a right to review it, that the fact that they did occur, and if you take them all in their entirety, that there was probable harm. And we feel that Judge Smedley wrote on this in the Scoggins case. We think that we have cited you cases in our brief that would reflect that all of this would constitute probable harm. We also bring out the point that counsel brought out regarding the other issues that the Court of Civil Appeals did not address itself to. This was in regard to the punitive damage. And we would feel, contrary to what counsel says, that should be, if the court does not agree with us on affirming the Court of Civil Appeals, that the court in turn would remand this back to the Court of Civil Appeals to determine those other points that were raised on appeal. Thank you so much, Jim.
Thank you, counsel.
Your Honor, I've been accused of misstating the record to the court. If I did, it certainly was not intentional. I apologize to the court. I do not believe that I misstated any portion of the testimony. It has been stated that there was no conflict between the testimony of these four jurors who was called to testify. It's beyond dispute that the two jurors who dissented testified that the issue of attorney's fees and insurance and wages were discussed in connection with special issue number 2. But there is conflicting evidence in this testimony. Juror on page 35 in lines 14 to 17, I asked Mr. Norton, did you say anything in your deliberations about insurance and insurance company going to be the one to pay the verdict? And his answer was no, period. I asked Mrs. Anderson, do you have a discussion of basing your verdict on the amount of attorney's fees that Mr. Strange was going to pay? Her answer was no.
Was the context of those questions you meaning the jury or you meaning the individual being questioned?
To be honest with you, Your Honor, I'm not sure that I can answer that question. I asked it back then. In the context of the motion for new trial, I would have thinking that you, the jury, you as a plural pronoun, this court, the rules of interpretation say this court is bound to interpret the judge's decision in the light most favorable to uphold his decision. I guess that if you want to uphold the trial court, you would say that there is a plural interpretation to be given to that pronoun. Counsel for Treasure City would be more restrictive in trying to find no conflict and say that you would be a singular pronoun and would be limited strictly to that one juror.
Does the record show whether just one juror was there or whether more than one juror was there?
I don't believe the record speaks to that point, Your Honor. Mr. Kaufman has raised the issue of, he read some testimony about from Mr. Braun that said that the jury considered the cost of a deposition that the plaintiff, Mr. Strange, had to pay. Well, the Court of Civil Appeals didn't even find any misconduct in that regard. And even then, there was testimony on page 36. Did you discuss or do you recall any other juror discussing whether or not the amount of money Mr. Strange had to pay for depositions? The answer was no. With regard to that testimony about calculating lost wages, it was the jury foreman, the man was brought down there, the man who testified that he played the devil's advocate on the whole thing. He was the one that testified that he was the one that did the calculation about lost wages. But Mr. Norton testified, we did not calculate any amount or how much he was out, that sort of thing. I think that there is testimony in the record that the trial court found there was conflicts. He was the one that heard the verdict. The cases say that the trial court's given great latitude in deciding this testimony. He's the one that sits there and listens to it, decides the weight to be given to the testimony, considers the motives. I know that the two courts of civil appeals, one of them was a Tees versus Tees opinion, another one was Penner versus State Highway, where the courts of civil appeals said, well, these two jurors that came down and testified about the misconduct, they didn't join the verdict anyway. So there couldn't have been misconduct because it was 10-2 verdicts. So I think that the trial court is to be given latitude in deciding the motives, the demeanor, and the credibility of these witnesses. And I think that the trial court's decision is to be binding on the appellate court. Mr. Kaufman complained that we did not bring Mrs. Sanchez down to the court to testify. The burden of proof was not on us. We were not the complaining party. We didn't have to bring anybody down to prove anything. He says we should have brought her down there to prove it didn't happen. Well, that's not what Rule 327 is all about, as interpreted by this court. Before 1905, there was a rule in Texas that said a jury cannot impeach its verdict. In 1905, Article 2234 was enacted, which allowed a jury to testify about its verdict. And there was a great deal of problems that arose after 1905, and in 1939, the current Texas Rule of Civil Procedure 327 was enacted, which said that it was upon the complaining party to prove the harm. Prior to Rule 327, once misconduct was proved, then it was incumbent upon the party who had the verdict in his favor to show beyond a reasonable doubt that there was no harm. That is the case law that Mr. Kaufman is relying on. That is the case law that is cited in the Court of Civil Appeals opinion. San Antonio versus McKenzie was the case decided by this court in 1941, but it, as I understand it, was tried back in 1939, and they applied the case law that was in effect prior to Rule 327. And that's the case law that the Court of Civil Appeals relied on, saying that it was incumbent upon us to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that harm did not occur. We do not have the burden any longer. It is the burden on the complaining party. Now, the counsel for defendant engaged in some speculation as to what Mrs. Richards might have been thinking when she was discussing that she had a personal reason for wanting to award $14,500 in exemplary damage. Clearly, this goes into what her reasoning process was. He suggests, well, she might have been a Mexican and she might have been a minority and sympathizing. Who knows? But the whole thing goes into her reasoning process. And as this court said in that Putnam versus Lazarus case, that is not a proper subject to either sustain or destroy a verdict. Now, mental processes, I have a great deal of difficulty in trying to decide what does the court actually mean when it says you should not consider mental processes. What are
counsel,
mental processes?
Counsel, to me, when somebody in a jury room says something, that's an overt act. It's the saying of the thing that takes it out of the mental process. It then becomes an overt act. Now, you can't put a juror on the witness stand and ask them what they thought, but you can ask that juror what they said. And to me, this is the distinction.
But as Your Honor pointed out in that 1962 Baylor Law Review article, speech is thought.
And well, this is true. But nevertheless, you can show what was said. You can't say what they thought.
Well, but and even though here is a juror who expresses, I don't want to disclose what my personal thoughts are. But other jurors are trying to get her to say, what are your personal thoughts? And she says, I don't want to tell you why I want to award $14,500 exemplary damages. She didn't discuss it. The jury didn't discuss it. It was within what was working in her mind in arriving at that figure was not the subject to be inquired about. She refused to discuss it. Tell them why. And I don't think it was within the province of the trial court or the appellate court to say that it was error that she didn't divulge and they didn't discuss what was going on inside her mind. This Putnam versus Lazarus case, I find it very helpful because in that case, Judge Brewster set out the testimony of four jurors and he italicized a portion of the testimony. And then he said that portion that was italicized relates to the mental processes, which is not the subject of inquiry. In that case, it was the issue of insurance that was injected. Judge Brewster says the following comments are mental processes and cannot be considered on appeal. Juror Thomas testified, quote, and the reason he finally agreed to $5,000 was because he knew that in all probability the judgment would be paid by insurance, but this was not necessarily due to the statement that was made, close quote. Judge Brewster says that's mental processes and cannot be considered by the appellate court. Mrs. Tommy Cook stated, quote, that she felt that the insurance company would have to pay the damage, but this was not due just to the statement that had been made, that she thought it was probably a $10,000 policy and she was giving petitioner half of what he could get, close quote. Judge Brewster said that was mental process. Mrs. Glenn Ledoux said, quote, she thought respondent had insurance and that the company would have to pay the bill, which is one of the reasons she voted to give petitioner as much as $5,000, close quote. Mrs. Raymond Moore testified, quote, but it was not the insurance company that influenced her one way or the other, close quote. Now, the other testimony that these jurors gave is set out in the opinion. But here again, it's not to argue with Your Honor, but there is an oral expression of what was going on in the jurors' mind, what they were thinking. And so just the fact that there was speech.
Did these witnesses say those things in the deliberations? Or were they not on the witness stand being asked, now what were you thinking about?
Well, according to the opinion that these jurors that testified on the motion for new trial, the court says that the testimony that before the jury agreed on the amount of damages, one of the jurors said respondent had probably had insurance, and that the foreman or another juror immediately stated that that should not be discussed or considered, and that there was no further discussion of the subject. And then that's when the testimony took place. And Mr. Sam A. Thomas testified that the reason he finally agreed to $5,000 was he knew in all probability the judgment would be paid by insurance, and the judgment But this was not necessarily due to the statement that was made.
Well, now that's the part that's the mental process.
Yes. But this is what I'm saying is the mere fact that some matters are discussed and are considered by the jury and they talk about these things at the hearing for motion for new trial, such as the statement of one person speculating that a black man might not be able to get a fair trial. The mere fact that someone reveals a mental process, I don't think is per se misconduct. That the court should not just say that the mere fact that he said it is misconduct, that they should consider what was said, consider the materiality of it, and consider whether probable harm resulted to the person before they find that material misconduct resulted in the defendant not getting a fair trial.
The case is submitted on written briefs and oral argument.